Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
The aftermath of every social revolution brings about change. Cultural norms and landmarks shift as our minds and hearts expand beyond the familiar. To everything, there is a season and a time to every purpose in the land of the living. This is our time to renew, revive, and restore the hope lost to the busyness of life. This is our time to dig again and rebuild from the storms of our past on a solid footing that holds. Welcome to The Foundation.
The Foundation. The Foundation
with Howard Grant is brought to you by Alive, Bahamas Bus and Truck, the Bahamas Football Association, Burger King, Commonwealth Bank, and Wendy's.
The Foundation. The Foundation.
Foundation that's rocking the nation. Howard Grant's the host, Guardian Radio Station. 96 Bright 9, 12 to 2 is the time. You can call the show or use the text line. Yeah, he educates, he informs. He goes against the norm. He's really got that zeal. Plus, he's a child of God.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. 96.9 FM Radio, Howard Grant in your company, The Foundation. On this beautiful Monday morning, so happy to be in your company today. It's the 1st of May, the month of grace. Can I say that? Can I get a little taste preachy with you at least? Today is a beautiful day, so happy to be here. I don't know about you, but I had some dreams last night that indicate that we're going to be able to step into some strong seasons. I'm excited about it. Talk to me, Howard, are you superstitious? Mad superstitious. I was grown by black people. It's deep in me, right? You need to stop. It's a beautiful day, ladies and gentlemen. I want to thank all those persons that remain committed in terms of being able to sponsor the show and committed to tuning in here at 96.9 FM radio. I'm so happy to be in your company today. First off, I want to be able to say I didn't know this until I just opened up my phone maybe about half an hour ago. But I want to say, and someone please hit me up if I'm wrong. I don't want to just kind of do this thing from social media, but I feel as though it's a strong source that says to me that Ronnie Ambrister has passed away. I've just read that information in there to say that Ronnie Ambrister has passed away. Now, I know Ronnie Ambrister. A lot of you know Ronnie Ambrister from his association as a president over at the Bahamas Music. I forget the acronym, but right over here at the Bahamas Music at the top of the hill. And on Carter Street. And he and I just had a conversation. I'm just getting into this typical thing, right? So he and I just had a conversation about 3 months ago. Two months ago. And I've committed to kind of doing some stuff, looking for a place to kind of put my office. So he and I talked very well and seemed to be in good spirits at the time. But, you know, life has a way of being able to kind of, you know, pull you down quickly. So if he has passed away, guys, give me a call if I'm on the right track. I don't want to just kind of repeat things off social media, but like I said, I really do believe that this is a strong source that has been sending some condolences to him and the persons attached to it, and I want to be part of that. You know, he's also a MCM of the Free National Movement, so I know that they're going to be able to continue to shower him with the accolades according to that. The hit me up today, 323-6232, 325-4316, 325-4259. Hit me up anywhere, toll-free, absolutely toll-free, 242-300-5720, or text me at 422-4796. I wanted you to be a part of that. Make sure you pick up your papers today. The National Guardian, May 1st, you can be able to pick it up. You can see that the UN halt Haiti deportation committee urges countries to halt forced return of Haiti. That's a deep conversation. We've got to get into that. We structured a conversation to be able to dive into today. We did that. I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the 25th clerk in the House of Assembly and his sort of a stellar contribution and being in that particular space. I want to talk about his years of commitment, even coming in. I know a great deal of persons out there, if you are really paying attention to national issues, you would know from 1993 when he came in, during this time of a transition in the country, he brought a certain level of this and a standard that he upheld to be able to provide a true sense of, like one of the articles that indicate that he was a consummate professional and a stickler for the rules. He's remained committed even after 2017 in his retirement state to talk about good governance in the country and what needs to happen. Sort of a social tussle in the newspaper, sometimes taboo against sort of the rhythm and direction of administrations of the day. Really hard sometimes to swallow, but this is the constitutional standard for the country. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to introduce you to who I believe to be, because I don't know all of him. I only know him. And I'm able to kind of measure what my expectations are for a chief clerk in the House of Assembly. I want to be able to introduce you to former chief clerk of the House of Assembly, none other than Maurice Tynes. Mr. Tynes, good afternoon, my brother. How are you doing today?
Good afternoon, Brother Grant. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Man, you are a good, decent man. Like I said, I'm very grateful for you to being able to take on all this opportunity to talk about what's happening in the country. First and foremost, for those persons who don't know you or they need to be able to jog their memory, let them know who you are and what you would have done here in the country over those years.
Well, I am the third child of Clarence and Lottie Tynes. I grew up in Fox Hill. Mm-hmm. I started my professional work experience at the Immigration Department. I also worked for a number of years at the Cabinet Office. And then in 1993, I was asked to come over to be the clerk of the Parliament. Mm-hmm. And so I served, like you said, I served as clerk until August 2017.
Mm-hmm. So that would have been 24 years of service, but you haven't rendered anymore. I mean, you haven't stopped. You're still serving, even though you're not in this particular role.
Yeah, that's 24 years of service to the Parliament. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, I've been in the I've done over close to 48 years total in the public service.
In public service,
yeah. Like I said, I served about 12.
You served your whole life.
Yes. I served about 12 years in the Immigration Department and about 12 years at the Cabinet Office.
Before. I can ask you this question. Because you indicated that, we can just hit me. I can go there. Amidst everything that happened in the country, ladies and gentlemen, I know this is not, you know, the ideal place to start from, but only because he served 48 years in public service, I have to ask this question. Amidst what was going on in the country, at the end of the 70s and the beginning of the 80s, with this transition that happened in the country, and this introduction of drugs, so forth and so on, we watched morality shift course. We watched social morality and people being able to do what is right because it's right, because we've been taught this, take a different avenue, and looking for an opportunity to be able to serve themselves. You have remained steadfast in your commitment, and we see this. Why I say that? Because we see this in your service to the House of Assembly, in your commitment to what is right and being able to talk about that, the tangibles, the intangibles, what needs to happen, even now, years after you were retired. What is the anchor that kept you on this particular course to say and do what is right?
I don't know. I think I was grounded in morality by my parents. Both of them who were public servants. And I just think that a career in the public service is one of the most enriching experiences you can have. You ask, why do I continue? One of One of the criticisms I have of other former public servants is that the public service generally always had and still has some of the most capable minds in the country. And these, when you serve over 40 years, you accumulate a lot of experience and know-how. And I am kind of disappointed that the persons who have already retired do not continue to give back and serve the various communities.
Mr. Tynes, we can go deep in this conversation because that is the exact question I asked myself. Why is Mr. Tynes serving in this particular capacity? It feels like you're an NGO, like you're a non-governmental organization unto yourself, being able to speak truth to power relentlessly and people yearning and looking for this sort of a compass that continues to be able to direct us to the north. Whilst we're seeing other persons, watch me, we're watching other persons who have retired from the public service and based upon their proximity and relationships and so forth and so on, whether or not they're in fraternity, find a way to get back into government, to get paid, whether in the consultancy capacity or not, but still don't render that service, that genuine service, to right course the country the way that we desire. Talk to me about that.
I don't know. I haven't been asked to return, so I can only surmise from that you know that my services are not really wanted. I see all kinds of people going back in. I think I probably had more to offer than a lot of them do.
I say I could be decent. I could try to be decent today because the truth is, people, relationships and proximity affords opportunity, especially when it comes to currency, to getting paid. But if there is integrity and people could be able to see that maybe this particular person would always be sort of the whistleblower in here, they reject you. If you're not yielding yourself like a yes man, they reject you. You have been the social integrity in keeping that particular bar high over the years. So I don't know if they can give you a call, right?
I doubt it.
But I want to talk about this. I want to talk about, we can start off in this particular manner because there's a lot of social issues I want to touch. And I want to talk about more specifically, I send that over to you. I want to talk about integrity. I want to talk about conviction. I want to talk about the role and responsibility of backbenchers. I want to talk about a parliamentary democracy, whether or not it's lost its standards and is sort of a bearing socially. And I want to talk about some things like that. But more specifically, I want to talk about your role. When I was younger, and they started to talk about this idea of a clerk. I was a clerk. Let me tell you why I was a clerk. I was a store clerk, right? I worked for Burns House when I fresh out of school. Mm-hmm. I needed a job. I needed something to do before I went to college. This was persons in this time call a gap year, right? So fresh out of high school, wanted to find something to make some money. And I got a job as a store clerk at Burns House in Grand Bahama, right? I've always had this sort of disdain and look down on store clerks after I was in the role and responsibility. Me, right? I had to mop the floor, clean this, do that, all these things. I said, oh my God, I don't think I would be a clerk. And then what we believe to be office clerks don't necessarily have the prestige. But if we look in the House of Assembly, going all the way back to what I think is 13, in the early 13 or the mid 1300s, we would see that the first clerk was appointed into the House of Assembly. And the prestige associated in the roles and responsibility being able to attach to that advisor to the House, to do the procedures of the speaker, right? And the MPs, to keep the records, the prep the agenda, so forth and so on. This is a significant role that I don't think we as a society, especially many persons in school, high school, don't learn more about. We don't understand these particular things. So talk to me about that sort of a position of what a clerk is and what it means to be a clerk in the House of Assembly.
Okay. The clerk, I say clerk.
Okay, good.
The clerk of the of the House of Assembly or the Senate, their main responsibility is to give procedural advice to the Speaker and to the members of Parliament. They're also the chief administrator of the parliamentary staff. They have to, like you said, they have to prepare the agenda. They have to sign the bills. You know, it's a unique service in the public service. There's no other place in the public service where you do this kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
And you find that when people come into the House Assembly and they're doing that clerkship, or they, you know, there are three clerks at the table. They mm-hmm. call them table clerks.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a table clerk, you tend to be there for your life. Because it takes a long time to really learn and master the rules and procedures of our Westminster system.
Is this why the first clerk would have actually begged for leave, took vacation, never came back, right?
Yeah, I think he was the clerk for the governor.
Yeah, for the governor, yeah.
Yeah, and they moved him over to the House. And the members of the Parliament never really trusted him because they thought he was still a creature of the governor. But anyhow, when we have these international conferences, there's a joke that goes around that they call the clerks cockroaches.
Mm.
Say they survive earthquakes, hurricanes, they survive everything and stay in place.
Yeah.
they survive the upheavals of general elections.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So they call us cockroaches. But anyhow, but it's a very, very important job. And it is one that I was really, I really took to heart. And you get to meet a lot of politicians and you interact with them. And, you still have to know where your place is and what your proper role is. And I think I kind of figured that out kind of early within my career at the Parliament.
Mm-hmm. So talk to me about this. What is the sort of integrity associated with this? Is it just proximity? Is it years of service? Is it a sense of consistency? What identified you? I think you told me this story before, but what identified you in 1993 for them to give you such a prestigious position in the House of Assembly?
Like I said, I was working in the Capitol Office.
Mm-hmm.
The Capitol Office, for some reason, always chose, or the clerk of the Senate always came from the Capitol Office,
mm-hmm.
which really ought not to happen.
Mm-hmm.
They're two different branches of government.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was the person in the Capitol Office who they chose to be the clerk of the Senate. So I was clerk of the Senate first. And that's where I got a lot of...
So you knew procedures?
I got to know the procedures.
Mm-hmm.
And, I actually was there before, in the House before, because when Percy Saunders died,
mm-hmm.
he was the clerk, a long-time clerk. When he died, Sir Lyndon asked me if mm-hmm. I wanted to be the clerk of the House.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, no, I wasn't really interested in that. So he asked me if I would go over there and serve it as the clerk until he finds someone else.
Mm-hmm.
I told him, sure. And I went over there. I served about a month or two, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then they found clerk.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but he only stayed about 2 years. And then when Mr. Ingram became the prime minister, mm-hmm. he didn't really give me a choice.
Mm-hmm.
He said, Tan, I said, well, I want you to
That's
go
what you're doing.
Yeah.
But you did a very good job, a stellar job. And, sometimes if people hear the backdrop of this story, they would always think that there was a sort of a commitment and that you'd pay this sort of a indenture or this kind of commitment to the former Prime Minister Ingram. But you had integrity beyond that. You stood for rules and regulations. You stood for what's right. Is this what we should expect from anyone serving in these particular capacities?
Certainly. I think you should expect that from all of your public servants, because the public servants are the ones who give advice and serve the ministers. And so I think the permanent secretaries and all the other senior people, it's essential that they are persons of integrity and neutrality, mm-hmm. neutral as much as they can be. Mm-hmm. And you know, in the House of Assembly, you have to serve both parties, mm-hmm. both the leader of the opposition and the prime minister. Sometimes both of them will end up in your office at the same time, coming to ask a question or advice. Mm-hmm. And so I think integrity is something that ought to be just something that you just do naturally.
I think, you know, here on this show, here at the Foundation, I don't know why I gravitate to people who, this guy called the radio station the other day or text me, I don't know, I can't remember what it was, but he says to me that I am an idealist. I wrapped up in the idea of what things should possibly be, but not necessarily viewing things as they are. Mm-hmm. And I believe that as I listen to you, I think you have these particular ideals, a desire to be able to uphold the Constitution and what should be done. But if we really look at the environment, especially post, I want to say, 82, post-82, when the country started to take on a different shape because what was being introduced to it, a lot of persons became all for me, let me get grabbed for myself. And the public service reflected that significantly, where even now in 2023, there is a subconscious quiet expectation. It's almost like if somebody going to eat flamingo or donkey in Agua, they call it hush. There is a hush concept as it relates to being able to get expedience in the public service. They know you got to carry lunch money, you got to do this, you got to do that quietly. They don't say this to no one. But this is almost an unwritten rule. But you're sitting here and talking to me about this idea of integrity and upholding this kind of position in the public service. Talk to me about whether or not you believe our public service has shifted its course over the course of our 50 years as we celebrate Jubilee this year. Now, I want you to put that there. I put that on the table, ladies and gentlemen, but I got to take my first commercial break. 96.9 FM Radio, Guardian Radio, Howard Grant and your company with the Foundation sitting here talking to none other than Maurice Times. I had to put the question on the table. Let me take this quick commercial break and be right back after this.
Foundation. Foundation.
The Foundation. We'll be back right after this.
The Foundation. The Foundation. The Foundation. The Foundation.
The Foundation. Ready to step into the future? From your front door to the backyard and everywhere in between. See and speak to whoever's there with Ring Video doorbells and security cameras now available at Alive. Protect what matters most, all from one easy app, available in your Google or Apple Play Store. Visit bealive.com/ring to learn more. We are Alive.
Ready for the ultimate beach soccer showdown. The Bahamas Football Association presents the 2023 CONCACAF Beach Soccer Championship from May 8th to 14th. Head to the Beach Soccer Stadium beside the Sir Sidney Poitier Bridge and witness the action. Cheer on the Beach Boys as they compete against powerhouses from 11 countries across the region, like Mexico, El Salvador, and the USA. Gather your friends, family, and flags and cheer on our Beach Boys. Admission is absolutely free. For more information, visit BahamasFA.net. Don't miss out on all the action at the 2023 CONCACAF Beach Soccer Championship, May 8th to 14th. See you there.
This is Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Foundation. Foundation. The Foundation. The Foundation. Foundation. The Foundation.
And we are back, ladies and gentlemen, 96.9 FM radio. Howard Grant in your company. I know you are itching to get to the meat and potatoes of the conversation, but let's set up a good little foundation. Let's set up at least the barriers to knowing and beyond this particular point. Before we went to the break, I wanted to ask you this. Like I said, I believe that you're an idealist in the spirit and idea of executing your job and capacity as a public servant. Right? You should have integrity. You should be able to uphold these particular standards. You should carry yourself in this particular manner. This idea is great. But in theory, it exists. The practical application for a great deal of us that exist in this space that has the ease of doing business continue to be able to trickle down the ladder, and we continue to trickle down that regionally. We look at it and we know that the only thing that can give us expedience, the only thing that can be able to ensure that my business gets done subconsciously, quietly, is this sort of an idea to pay for expedience. So I want to know from you, how do we purge that mindset, that spirit, that idea that exists, not in all now. I can't put in all the everyone in the public service. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying to you, for the most part, the bad apples. How do we extract that to be able to get to significant productivity, not just mere busyness, but productivity in the public sector?
I think you either have integrity or you don't. Mm. In addition to that, I think that within the structure of the public service, there's no inbuilt accountability, and so the guy who collects the money in customs or does clearing a product for somebody, he expects to get paid on the side. Mm. Because there's no, in his area, there's no one he has to account to for that. And there's no, and institutionally, they have not put in the structure of their department all of the standards and the accountability and that is required to serve the public. Mm. And we have to remember that we are public servants. We are there to serve mm-hmm. the public. Mm-hmm. And so we ought not to be getting paid twice for it. Mm. I think one of the things I kind of advocate for is we are each of the large departments and ministries should have some officer assigned to ensure this accountability within the structure of their department or their ministry. I think that is missing within the institutions in the public service, and they leave it to the public to the permanent secretary to do this. But you know, the permanent secretary that person has to overlook the entire department, the entire ministry. So I think we need officers assigned to do the accountability work within the departments and the ministries.
I like what you said. Now I'm going to go to sort of the role and responsibility for the clerk for the House of Assembly. Tell me to say clerk, don't say clerk. Okay, watch me. One of the things that you do, I highlighted two things because I was hoping that the conversation take this direction. I highlight two things. Keep records and keep record on how the MPs vote. Both the idea and concept of being able to keep record, the first thing I think about is, you know, manually writing these particular things down. There has been a significant shift globally where the introduction of technology has given a significant increase in level of accountability. You can't modify these things. Nobody could tear the page out. This exists in a space that generations from now, persons can be able to identify who came to work at what time, who did this, how they voted, so forth and so on. Our country has done a disservice to itself, in my view, personally, by being able to be slow with the incorporation of technologies. They always kind of, you know, amp up this idea that we've done this. It's a 10-year-old technology. This is 15 years old, 20 years old. Oh, we've done those particular things. I ask you, when you start to talk about accountability, do you believe that technology should play more of a significant role in ensuring that there is a standard of accountability to be able to ensure that everybody stays in line?
Oh, certainly, certainly. I think the digitalization in the public service has been too slow.
Mm-hmm.
Just like all reforms within the parliamentary system has been very, very slow.
Mm-hmm.
In some of my recent writings, I tried to show where, you know, women got the vote as late as 1962, which mm-hmm. is, in terms of history, is a very, very recent. Is very recent.
Mm-hmm.
We stopped doing open voting, and we just got secret ballot in 1949.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, you had to go in openly and say who you're going to vote for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was open to intimidation and abuse.
Mm-hmm.
So we have reforms have come to the public service very slowly. And I fault the politicians for that.
Mm.
In the House of Assembly, you don't have records of how people voted unless there is a call for actual head count. If that was not requested, then no record is kept of who voted for what. Now, I believe for all bills, there ought to be a head count
mm-hmm.
to see who voted how, who abstained, who didn't show up for the vote. I think all those things, there should be transparency in those things.
Mm-hmm.
And
To the state, the Senate in the states, you could see who representative did what they voted, so forth and so on.
Exactly.
Okay.
You see, but you know, our recent elections have been so one-sided that you know, there's no urgent push for these kind of reforms.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the reforms have to come from the push from the people. Okay, so if I want to know how my member parliament voted on any bill, so I can't find that out unless there was a request for a head count,
or
what they call in the parliament a division.
You know, I'm listening, and I'm so wrapped up in the conversation, I forget I have to do this. But I have to ask these questions, because the truth is that social conditioning has afforded an opportunity where there won't be social agitation there. The conditioning that exists in your community, the sort of position that you've taken for your political organization, the ideas that has been spilled to you through propaganda that you've accepted as fact or truth, places you in a position where you are, many of us, in this sort of, if that's what the party say, that's what the party say. Yeah. And not necessarily saying, well, is this good for the country? So when we start to talk like this, there could be no expectation if there is a lack of accountability, if there's a lack of integrity, and I want to talk about that next. If there's a lack of accountability, integrity within our system, within the political organizations, when they actually have an opportunity to be able to ascend to government, they're going to bring these same sort of ways, quote unquote, with them. So I want to talk about that. How do we circumvent them? How is there a way to be able to circumvent and go around what we know will end up to the exact same traditional space with politicians to get to social productivity and growth?
Let me say this. The representative nature of our system, where a member represents 4,000-5,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
That ought to that requires the member. He's not going to go around and ask each person how I should vote. But when he goes into Parliament and he makes a vote on your behalf, he then ought to account for that vote.
Mm-hmm.
And so members of Parliament ought to hold town hall meetings, mm-hmm. or whatever community organization that they put up to first of all, before the vote, to try to get a consensus of how the people want you, what are their views on this issue. And then you bring in experts on the issue who would explain to the people what is the purpose of this bill,
mm-hmm.
what are they trying to accomplish,
mm-hmm.
and then they have some kind of understanding when you get up in there, and then you stand up and you say, "I, on behalf of the wonderful people of this or such and such,"
because I already did have a meeting.
Yeah,
I consulted with my people.
Exactly,
I brought the experts. I explained to them. So on behalf of my people, we take this position.
Yes,
we don't see that.
No, so this, you know, I think those kind of things are missing from our system. You see, when the PLP got to power in 1967,
mm-hmm.
most of the electoral reforms had already been done.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, women had the right to vote by then. There was no more open voting. The property qualifications to be able to vote were
one man, already, one vote. All of these things would have already taken place.
One man, one vote had already taken place.
All these things done.
So these other reforms that ought to have been done,
mm-hmm.
have not really been done, and I think one of the reasons I think that's been holding us back is that there is a great need for a new parliamentary complex.
Mm.
The building there that they'll be using now for the House and the Senate, they have been there from the early 19th century, 1806 or 1807. They were 200 years old. And when they were built for staff of one or two persons.
I have to smile because are you saying indirectly to me, when members, men and women, step into the House of Assembly based upon this kind of an ancient existence, they automatically take on this traditional yesteryear mindset?
No, I'm not suggesting that. But I'm saying that a lot of the technical matters that ought to have been established within the Parliament cannot be established because of the age of the building and, you know, some of the electrical stuff there, they've been changed.
Yeah.
But they've been there for decades and decades.
Yes. Yes.
And, you know, and they can't accommodate some of the new technology. So, they really need a new parliamentary complex.
You know,
I always argue that they have no problem building buildings for the executive branch, a new Ministry of National Security, a new Ministry of Office for the Attorney General, a new ministry for this, a new building, and they don't have any problems building courts or remodeling courts for the judiciary,
mm-hmm.
but they have not done anything for the Parliament in all of these years.
Let's ramp it up for 2 seconds before we go to a commercial break. I got to take a commercial break for 1 o'clock, but let's ramp it up for 2 seconds before we do that. Is it possible? Now, I know you can't emphatically state this particular position because, you know, there are significant sort of theories that exist, these sort of ideas, conspiracy theories that exist, that this is possibly why they've done that. Because many of us say the same thing. Why haven't they fixed this? Why have they fixed that? Especially under this government in the sunshine with Hubert Ingraham in his particular capacity, who would always espouse and boast about, you know, how many schools we've done, the infrastructure that we've done over there, but not being able to identify and rectify whether it be the funds that a member of parliament should make in a changing society or the actual institution. And so we question ourselves. Over the years, I asked myself, well, why would they have done that? And in the true spirit of a conspiracy, I say to myself, is it because they want to retain this position? Is it because they want to create this kind of a space where there is organized confusion? That the only persons who know how to fix these things, you always have to kind of go back to them and depend on them. Whereas transparency, accountability, and that sort of technical advancement or technological advancement, you could put anyone in this place and the system should still be able to always remain buoyant. Why is it that they've never placed the emphasis, and I'm talking about leadership, successive leadership over the years, why have they placed an emphasis on being able to rectify and reform what needs to happen for the country?
Well, you spoke about the emoluments that parliamentarians receive.
Mm-hmm.
I think parliamentarians have gotten themselves in a position where they feel the people don't trust them. There is a view out there that politicians make a lot of money from the parliament and for their government service. And that's not true at all. The member of parliament. Thirty-nine of them. They make the same $28,000 that they've been making from 1988.
I know.
Yeah, I think that in itself is a disgrace.
Absolute disgrace.
I think they have been put in the corner to do anything about it, because they think the people are going to say, you're grabbing more for yourself.
Watch me. We got 5 minutes before we go there. I got to touch this quick because I don't want to forget it. I have come to the conclusion, because I have to ask myself in the spirit of deduction, why? Why every time a member, most recently we would have seen Travis Robinson being able to take on a particular position and talk about that and completely shut down. But the backbenchers who are only making the $28,000 can't even exist in this society. And leadership would identify them in many spaces and say, hey, I want to give you an opportunity to be the chairman of this board, or I want to give you an opportunity to be able to serve in this particular capacity, and accept an additional check. And so instantaneously weakening the position of the backbenchers, because the only thing you're doing is taking the $28,000. And if you want to get additional to survive in this society with the requirements you have to buy a new suit, at least two suits a quarter, then you're going to need to be able to do what you have to do. And it really hasn't given the strength to the backbenchers because of this $28,000. What are your thoughts?
See, prime ministers over the last, I think from 1992, 1997... Because they've been winning by such large margin, they are able to do that. They are able to offer this person this thing, or that person that thing, leaving no backbench.
None.
But if the results of the elections were not so one-sided, they won't be able to do that so much, you know. They would need a backbench to really support them, and you know that's how the system really was. One of the most important jobs for the backbench is to serve on committees and serve as oversight over the government ministers and government ministries.
Mm.
That could hardly be done now, because all of the members are either cabinet ministers, PAL secretaries, or head of some government corporation or something like that, you know. And so the oversight, and I think one of the reasons why they do it. So there is no oversight.
We get in the subway, ladies and gentlemen, 96.9 FM. We didn't go through all the pleasantries. We got through the foundation. We get into the meat and potatoes. Let's take this quick commercial break, get to news, and be right back with the foundation after this.
The foundation. The foundation. Found foundation. Foundation. The foundation.
The foundation. We'll be back right after this.
The foundation. Tired of banks forcing you to use technology to bank the way they want you to? Your convenience is important. So no matter what your banking needs, Commonwealth Bank's friendly staff are always available in branch for that personal one-on-one service. But when you choose technology, our online and mobile banking app offers you state-of-the-art functionality. The choice is yours. Commonwealth Bank. Bank the way you want.
The sixth edition of the Bahamas Games are on the way. July 7th through the 15th, get ready for inter-island sporting competition in the spirit of unity and camaraderie. Which island is gonna win? It's the Bahamas Games. Our nation, our talent, our games. And look out for the V Games crew coming to your island soon. For more information, call 809-1242 or visit thebahamasgames.org.
This is Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM, Nassau, Bahamas.
Foundation. The foundation. The foundation. The foundation. The foundation.
And we are back, ladies and gentlemen, 96.9 FM Radio, Howard Grant in your company, The Foundation, this beautiful Monday, May 1st, the fifth month, the month of grace. We just pray that, you know, we realize, man, Howard, don't fight. Listen to me. We want to align ourselves with all our goals, aspirations. If you forgot the sort of declaration that you made at the top of the month, the top of the year, hey, let's revive ourselves and get to where we have to get. We got a little bit of time left. Let's continue to be able to move forward. Today, in the studio with me here at 96.9, I have a great guest in the studio, man. If you didn't have an opportunity to be able to catch the top of the conversation, make sure you go back and pick that up over at GuardianTalkRadio.com, GuardianTalkRadio.com. I'm sitting with none other than Maurice Time, former chief clerk of the House of Assembly. You'll tell me, say it decently. It's spelled clerk, but you say chief clerk. In the House of Assembly, he served 24 years and really being able to continue even after his retirement in 2017. His commitment to social integrity and what needs to be done from a governmental standpoint is second to none. So, Mr. Tynes, I'm so happy to be able to have you in the studio with me.
I'm happy to be here, Mr. Grant. There's one correction. The position is not chief clerk. Mm-hmm. It's the clerk of parliament or the clerk of the house. The term chief clerk is a clerical position within the public service.
Mm-hmm. You're the clerk, so you was never the...
It's the top person, the head of the department.
There wasn't a chief?
No.
It's
the clerk.
Just the clerk?
Just the clerk.
Okay. So we're doing that, ladies and gentlemen, and we're talking like this. You know, on the break we had a very you know, insightful conversation about what needs to happen. And I want to shift gears a little bit. I want to shift gears. You want to talk about the role and responsibility, and I want to touch that as it relates to what needs to happen. I want you to introduce that concept, and then I'll transition to some stuff.
There are a lot of things that ought to happen. I feel that when the when I think that the term local government ought to have started in New Providence, where all of the people live, most of the people live. And I told you during the break that in a true democracy, there ought to be two levels of representation. Mm-hmm. You ought to have representation at the local level and representation at the national level. I hold, and I'm not apologizing for it, that a lot of the persons who get elected to the House of Assembly, which is the national level, are more suited to serve at a community or local level.
Let me be more decent when I ask you this question, because I think indecency pop up in my head right away. In your 24 years of service to the House of Assembly, can you identify an era where you believe that there has been a shift socially where you're seeing representative who didn't necessarily have that particular caliber and expertise to articulate what needed to happen nationally?
I think you have to go back to the former conversation we had with salaries for the members of parliament. Did we do that on air?
Yeah, we did.
And then you're going to tell your wife and family, okay, I'm going to run for this area. If I win, I'm going to get a salary of $28,000 a year. I think that turns off a lot of people who would want to make a contribution, who are in a position to make a contribution. That stops them from offering themselves for election. Mm-hmm. So I think the amount of money isn't everything, but I think the money that you offer for the positions ought to mean something. It ought to be at a level where you could still take care of your family.
The orthodontist don't take favor at my position for my children to get braces. I can't walk in the office and say, "Well, as an MP, can you give me this free?" No. The school fees that needs to pay for the children that I have, and I won't have 1,000. I need to be able to have this kind of a social incentive. And when me and my wife laying down, she said, "Baby, you get this. Mm-hmm. I say, "Hold on, we have to consider this strongly." So I agree with what you're saying.
Yeah, you know, it's almost like you get the level of service that you pay for.
Wow.
You know that, and that's not very a nice thing to say.
Wow.
But it's almost becoming that now. Why? What else? Why? From 1988, you have not raised the level of emoluments that you offer a member of parliament. What could be the rationale for that?
I don't know.
You know, there is.
In the private sector, no one could offer Howard Grant $28,000 and say, "Howard, you want a job?"
No.
Sorry, sir, you're going to have to keep your money. I could hustle $28,000 a year. I ain't got time for that.
So I think. That is something that could be easily corrected.
Yeah.
You could do that in the budget in next month. In the budget coming next month, or end of this month. Mm-hmm. You could do that quickly. But, you know, the two levels of representation, the local government. So we ought to have divided New Providence into districts. I think the police already have the country divided into districts that they administer. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you can do it the way you want to. But, you know, 5 or 6 districts, each district would have their own local assembly, and that assembly would deal with issues that arise within those particular communities. And then you leave the election to the House of Assembly for people who have a broader perspective on global situations, and you look, you know, people who could speak to financing and technology.
That have been absolutely, I want to touch this for you, because I agree with what you're saying, and I know that this is going to take a different avenue, because I've espoused certain aspects of what my beliefs are with local government out of Grand Bahama. I'm working very closely with that. I believe that political organizations, more specifically leadership, with a desire to be able to perpetuate their party's position, has bastardized the concept of what local government should be and what it means for the country. Local government reflects central government in the country now as unfortunate. That every time that the PLP comes in, because the local government election in the country is every 3 years. So every time we see that the PLP comes in, instantaneously we see a shift within local government to reflect this sort of a position. And never being able to push back on anything from a local level or a national level. So it really bastardized productivity in our country, and people sort of just go along with the get along. So I think that that's a whole entire conversation to be able to have be had there. Now, I want to talk like this because I got to say one or two things to you. I want to shift the conversation in direction so we can be able to talk about more recent issues. In, I think this was 2018, June 2018, there was an article in the paper, rebels should have resigned and not waited to be fired by the prime minister. Now, this was talking about sort of the position that some of the members have taken from within the organization. I think it was the Free National Movement at the time. And to talk about the integrity associated with that. Now, most recently, there has been sort of a social pushback and a lot of social commentary associated with a member of parliament for North Abaco and his sort of position and what would have happened based upon the allegations that came out in the papers. Based on these allegations, I want to ask you, not specifically about the matter or anything like that, I'm talking about allegations and the prefix attached to members of parliament's name, the honorable attached to them based upon the constitution and what's wrapped in rules and regulations that govern the House of Assembly and members there within. Member in custody, police confirmed Cornish turned himself in. I want to talk to you about what should happen in this instance. What should happen after there has been, because this is the first time that we saw that in our society. What should happen with rules and regulations that govern the House of Assembly after a member, there's allegations made against a member. Strong allegations socially to say that he went contrary to the moral position and Christian values that we hold. What should be expected of them?
Well, I don't know if you can you can dismiss a person because of allegations. That, and I think that's the problem. The rules of the House do not speak to people who have been charged criminally in the courts. The Constitution, There is an expectation that when you are elected to the House of Assembly, you are elected for the full term unless you die or you resign.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know what you want to put in the rules to change that or to weaken that position that's in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be careful when we call in people who have not been charged. There is an honor code in the Westminster system that if you do something that undermines your government, your party, your government, then you ought to resign.
Mm-hmm.
We do not know if this. We have a situation even before this one right now. Adrian Gibson has been charged.
Mm-hmm.
He has not resigned.
Mm-hmm.
The party cannot force him to resign.
Mm-hmm.
The parliament can't force him to resign because he's been elected by people, the people of Long Island. Same thing with the young man now. Mm-hmm. He's been elected by the people of North Abaco, and they're the only ones who really could find him. There, we know one of the things I guess we can add to our democracy in the parliament is provide rules for impeachment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't have that. So if you want to impeach somebody because there are allegations against a person, that's gonna be, you know, it'll be very difficult.
Tell me this now, because I kind of hinge on this idea, maybe because of my proximity to the United States of America and kind of ingesting a lot of the the news that comes from the North. When there has been social allegations about a member, a public figure, in any capacity, there is a quiet expectation, whether you are the head of Enron, whether you are the head of Bank of America, where you're the head of, Facebook or in the House of Representatives, wherever you are, if there is something that comes out that is untoward, right, that goes against the social morality that's been spoken or unspoken of what our expectations are of leadership in these particular capacities, a leader in that area should be able to have the social integrity to be able to present himself, present his case, and step down in the interim. In our system, the Westminster system, a system wrapped in pomp and pageantry and wrapped in this sort of an idea of being able to show you rather than being able to apply in accordance, this idea, watch me, of honorability eludes a great deal of our members after social speculation or sort of allegations come forward. If this was me, as a young man, because I'm a younger man, I would take on sort of an agenda that I've seen happen in the United States of America, whether with the support of my wife or the support of others, being able to stand and say, these are the social allegations levied against me. I want to apologize to my constituents in these particular areas. I've done boom, 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 boom. After I've consulted with them, I've decided to be able to step back. There should be some level of integrity and honorability attached to this office. Other than that, it's a free-for-all. What are your thoughts on that?
No, I think we in the Bahamas, we associate allegations with guilt. I think that they are two separate things. If I am accused of, you know, I don't know the police saying that they're investigating. Now, when an ordinary citizen complains that they have been abused physically, the police don't take so long.
They pick you up right away. All right.
And they...
And your singlet.
If you're at work, they pick you up from work.
All right, talk to me.
And now, has this gentleman been treated the same way?
No.
I don't know.
The papers tell us that.
Yeah, and so they say that he voluntarily went in to be questioned.
With his lawyer?
Yes. The police have released him, I guess, because they're saying that they don't have sufficient evidence at that time to charge him.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the Bahamian society have to... If do you trust the police?
Mm.
That's the thing. Do you trust the police to do this fairly?
That's heavy.
Yeah.
There's a heavy conversation that you're having because now we have to dig deeper and say, do I believe this? It can't be. It has to be able to supersede all of these elements and come right down to the constituents. If I live in North Abaco, FNM or PLP, and I feel indifferent about this, let's say I know whoever this is, and I feel indifferent about this, there should be something that affords those particular persons in that constituency to be able to say, we want to be able to revoke.
Well, that's why you have to put the rules in the House for it.
Wow.
We have not been willing to do that.
No, we haven't.
No.
I want to take this telephone call. Ladies and gentlemen, please give me a call. 323-6232, 325-4316. 325-4259, anywhere from the Family Violence, 242-300-5720, or you can hit me up 422 4796. Caller on the line with us live. Go ahead. Go ahead, caller.
Hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good day, good day. Mr. Tynes, how you doing, sir?
I'm fine, thank you.
Hello?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm fine, thank you.
Ready, Papa? What's up?
Here just now.
What's up, Papa?
Yeah, I was trying to find out from Mr. Tynes. I know he might get a chance to answer these three questions, but when I listen to you all talking all the time, I had one question, but it ended up turning into two. Mr. Tynes, what I don't want to find out, right? Men, these things would they be bringing to the host assembly and stuff like that? The bills and different things, them.
Yes.
I was wondering if when you used to work in there, like the clerks and stuff, they the people who's write it up, or the permanent secretary from the different ministries write it up?
I don't know what you mean, write up the bills?
So you could understand exactly. You know, like when they're reading things, so I realize this is the worst it ever been. I know this cause you missing, although I know David Forbes is very competent and very good in what he's doing. I think he's the person in charge now.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Since you're gone, it looks like you get worse since my New Day government since 2021. This guy's from Central Grand Bahama and others, them, if they ever used to be like telling whosoever's the government, well, there's a mistake you make, there's a mistake, but it get worse now. So I was wondering if that's the people in the permanent secretaries and different ministries, what do up these bills, them?
The bills, the legislation is drafted by the Attorney General's office.
Oh, they're making a mistake.
I don't know what mistakes you're talking about.
No, you'll have to go and listen to the tapes. I ain't going to come and make no accusation for nothing. It ain't no big thing neither. No. It just get worse since you gone. You understand? They used to do it more. So I thought you used to be there helping them. And I think you were one of the best all my life. You say only 24 years, right? But all my life, I only know but Mr. Tynes and Mr. David Forbes used to be there. I forget the next one, right? These chaplain, the people who's praying stuff, how do they get them? How do they get them? Do they sign up, request to do it, or the government
no,
and go there and look
no,
for
no,
or they put their name
no,
forward?
The speaker normally chooses who the chaplain will be, yes.
So the Williams man, what do you mean something Williams?
It's Papa.
Yeah.
Papa.
Don't go there? Okay, leave that one alone. And check this one.
Thank you, Papa.
Howard. Go ahead. I think Tynes was there in 91 when they changed the brewery laws. I want no push that. I want to know some people out here who might be for that. Ask whosoever was the government and the opposition to come together and push it because they needed it for their rights. I want to know if that's something just the politicians.
What laws were they?
Boogery.
Huh?
Boogery.
Oh, God.
Well, I'm hanging up and listening.
Thank you, Papa. No, you was in 93. You was in 91.
No, I came there in 93, yeah.
Okay.
But I know of what he's talking about because, you know, like I said, I was working in the cabinet office and I had to, I used to actually sit in the cabinet meetings and take notes, take minutes. And so I know of what he's talking about.
You could write a whole book. You could write several books.
Well, I am writing.
You know, fellas say if you can release that one, you got to wait until, you know, you die.
Yeah. No, well, my book ain't about nothing to do with politics.
Okay, good.
I'm talking. A lot of the stuff used to be published now as letters.
Mm-hmm.
They come from chapters in my book. So I write about the electoral system and the parliamentary system. I try to keep myself restricted to those areas. Once in a while, I step out and comment on something that's happening.
That's why I frame my questions the way that I did, because I don't want to talk about any one individual. I want to talk about the spirit, the mindset, rules, regulations that govern this particular space that says to us, this is what needs to happen. And if there is integrity, if there is conviction, this is what should happen. Let me take a next telephone call. Caller, you on the line with us live. Go ahead.
Hey, yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Grant.
Good afternoon,
Mr.
Tynes. Good afternoon.
I have two observation, two questions. Question number one, is the House of autonomous in that recently in regards to the Public Accounts
Committee
for the request of government contract and whatnot, and later on you had the Attorney General who later said that the PAC was overstepping. And if these rules were established by the House of Assembly, I don't think that the AG has the authority to oversee that, because
I don't know whether or not we went in the succession of what happened. Michael Pintaud, in his particular capacity as head of the PAC, actually sent out letters to the permanent secretaries. Is that a good place to start from? The permanent secretaries then did not save, I believe, one or two. I can't remember, right? Is this where we're going with this? And now you're saying to me...
I just want to know, Mr. Times, if you can bring some clarity to what is the position, because I know he had asked the speaker to clarify that, because the PAC was established by the House of Assembly in order to keep the government's feet to the fire in regards to what was called, what we know as money bills and government spending.
Okay.
And if you're making that ineffective, you might as well don't have it. My second question that I'm going to hang up is, or statement is, until the MPs give some accounting for the $100,000
that they're getting
here.
I was going to read that. You just need to stop. Go ahead.
I don't think they should get any raise at all.
Until the MPs give accounting
until
for the $100,000.
Until we have a full accounting of what is being done with this $20 million that we give them every 5 years,
mm-hmm.
they don't need...
Every year.
$20 million a year?
No, $100,000 a year.
$100,000 a year per MP, but when it was introduced under the Ingram administration, I think it was 50. And Cheval Lalanne was responsible for it at that particular time. Because I remember, let me tell you what I remember. I remember because my mother had to give an account of how she's a member of parliament in Maroc.
Yeah.
You remember her,
right?
So she had to give an account of how she was spending it right down to... if the bus stop was painted, if you put a bump in the road, all these particular things. So you're saying now that as years progress, there isn't any accounting or social accounting on these
things? No, as far as I am aware, there is still a requirement to account, and those monies are supposed to be audited every year by the Auditor General's Department.
Mm-hmm. Now, back to his first question, he started to talk about the autonomy for the Public Accounts Committee.
Okay, the Public Accounts Committee is appointed by the Speaker of the House. It's the only committee in Parliament that's controlled by the opposition.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the oversight. Like I remember talking to you about oversight.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the oversight for the Parliament of the executive branch,
mm-hmm.
and I think the terms of the Public Accounts Committee are set out in the rules of the House,
mm-hmm.
and there's also in the Financial Administration Audit Act some stuff that they have to do they could do. Now, here in the Bahamas, we have had different interpretations of what the public...
You sound like this, the NIV Bible. What do you mean, different interpretations?
Yes. Yes, you've had different interpretations of the power of the Public Accounts Committee. I think the rules of the House require that the Public Accounts Committee all reports or any kind of financial statements are supposed to be automatically referred to the public, that's tabled, you know, those reports that are tabled in House Assembly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people get mixed up because the powers of the Public Accounts Committee in Great Britain are much wider. And they are wider because the Parliament is supreme in the United Kingdom. The Parliament is not supreme in the Bahamas. The Constitution is supreme in the Bahamas.
Mm.
So the rules of the House in the United Kingdom give the Public Accounts Committee wide
and they can make modifications to be able to expand it every time.
Yeah.
Okay.
In the Bahamas, we are
confined to this.
We are limited to say a month.
No matter how archaic or
outdated. Yeah, but you know, they're also the Public Accounts Committee has gone outside those limitations on a number of occasions.
So has Michael Pintaud stepped over his sort of the boundaries set up by the Constitution by sending letters to the permanent secretaries?
I don't know if it ought to have been as broad as that. But if he had questions that came under certain ministries, then he could direct those letters to those ministries. I mean, there might be some ministries that there are no questions or any kind of queries, you know. Yeah. There.
So, I ain't got nothing to do with this.
Yeah.
If we in
exactly
the PS.
So I think his queries ought to be limited to the areas where he really wants. It really looks like a fishing trip when you ask everybody.
Yeah.
So you need to define what
fishing
areas.
Trip or witch hunt, one or the other.
Yeah. Well, the witch hunt, I leave that one for Trump.
Okay. Good. Okay.
You know, the Public Accounts Committee is supposed to zero in on some inappropriate action or spending. Whenever you go contrary to what the budget was, the appropriations that have been approved in the budget, those are areas where the Public Accounts Committee.
So he expanded too wide.
Yeah, I think my cursory reading, where he sent letters to all permanent secretaries. I don't know if that was really. Required.
Let me take a next telephone call. Caller, you're on the line with us live. Go ahead. Go ahead, caller. Caller, you're on the line with us live. Go ahead.
Is that me?
Hey, how you doing, my brother? Turn your radio down.
How many days talking away so long with you and...
Turn your radio down. Turn your radio down.
Okay, I get it. Get out of the way. Maurice, how you doing?
I'm fine, Bremen. How you doing?
I'm all in, thank God.
That's good. I haven't seen you for a long time.
Yeah, okay.
Raymond, you got to turn your radio down. Okay, go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead. We're right here with you.
Yeah. I'm right here, Maurice, thank God.
That's good.
A couple of questions I want to ask you, right? If they were to have two sections of government within the House of Assembly, right? When I say two sections, I'm speaking about a higher house and a lower house, right?
Yeah, there are two.
They exist now.
Yeah.
Say it again?
The upper and the lower chamber, they exist now.
Okay. No, I didn't get you.
There's a house and the Senate already.
No. Okay, what I'm saying, right? You have a supreme government now, right? Who oversight everything.
What is the supreme government?
Right? If you were to have a lower... Also, a lower government, right? Two sections of government. Would both of them have to run for the House in order to get in there to run the country?
Oh, I don't know. Are you talking about when I talk about two levels of representation?
Right.
Local government and national.
Right.
No. The national.
Say it again?
No. The national government would do what it's doing now, passing laws.
Uh-huh.
That's what the national government is
right.
established to do, to pass laws for the peace, order, and good government of the country.
The local
government would deal with issues within their local communities.
But do they have to run for the House of Assembly?
No. They'll be elected from their various districts, from the district.
By their district.
By the people who live in their district.
Yeah, that already happens now in Grand Bahama and throughout the family of islands. You could actually vote for a member.
My other point is, right, Maurice?
Yes.
Now, $28,000 per year, a person would get if they run for parliament, right? If they were to get in, right?
Yeah, all parliamentarians.
Say again?
All House members get $28,000.
Well, let me ask you something. Why you suppose everybody or a lot of people want to run to get in there for that $28,000 when to some people that means nothing? They some people would leave their job with making more money.
You
know what I'm saying? Lawyers.
You're spilling into
there.
Speculation, and you're spilling it. You're spilling into speculation, Bremen. I got to let him answer that.
I'm not
speculating
Bremen, because you know yourself that some lawyers making a lot of money, and they still would run for the House of Assembly.
Yeah, Bremen. Some people like the prestige.
Thank you, Bremen. I can let you go.
And that's why they would run. some people like the power they think associated with being a parliamentarian. You know, they, you know, people run for different reasons.
I appreciate your decency keeping you right in those areas, right? Let me get to the next telephone. No, because we can't speculate what's happening in the person's mind. We can't. You see, one of the things that I see when I go to the opening of the House of Assembly, there are some proud parents in the audience. I'm talking about mothers, fathers,
yes,
who for the very first time can be able to hold their heads high and say, my God, the years of commitment, I never knew my son would do it. They had, mommy, that's my baby. It feels like a graduation because their child, right, no matter their age, have ascended to this kind of local office. For many of them, that's payment into itself.
And you see, they're also part of a tradition that goes back to 1729.
Yes.
Which, you know, without any kind of major interruptions during those 290-something years,
mm-hmm,
they are part of that tradition. The third oldest tradition in the Commonwealth.
Yes.
So,
yes,
you know, that is something to be proud
that's
of.
That's a prestige unto itself.
Yeah, yes. We should be very proud of our parliamentary history. Not history, but the fact that we have had this tradition since 1729.
I think it was you. I could be wrong. My mother in 2007 took me on a small tour. She said, you ever been in the house? I said, no. You know, we're from Grandmama. So she said, come on. And I'm sure it was you. You opened up this big book and showed me all the signatures of all these men and women who would have served over the years.
Yes.
And quietly in myself, I never tell my mother this. I said, well, I got to sign this book one day, right? So the idea and the prestige and the service associated with it is bigger than the money sometimes, especially if you know your worth and value to be able to bring it.
And you see that people look at that $100,000 that they get. That is not supposed to be used on their... That's not their personal money.
Mm-mm.
That is money that they are supposed to use for the infrastructure within their constituency.
Yes, yes.
And then they are supposed to account for it.
It was $50,000 initially for members of parliament and for cabinet ministers. It was
for everyone. No. It was the same for everybody.
Cabinet ministers didn't get an increase?
No.
Okay.
No.
Let me see if I can take the next telephone call. Caller, you're on the line with us live. Go ahead. Go ahead, caller. No? All right, let me take this telephone call. Let me take this commercial break, ladies and gentlemen. The lines are open for the last half of the show. 323-6232, 325-4316, 325-4259. Hit me up on the text line, 422-4796, or toll free, 242-300-5720. Quick commercial break, and be right back after this.
The Foundation.
Make your morning sizzle with breakfast from Burger King Nassau. Enjoy not one, but two delicious sausage and cheese croissant sandwiches made just for you for only $5.75, including VAT. This breakfast classic is made with Burger King's savory sizzling sausage and melted American cheese on that classic buttery croissant you love. So say hello to sizzling mornings at Burger King with two sausage and cheese croissant sandwiches for only $5.75, including VAT. Only at Burger King Nassau, where taste is king.
The sixth edition of the Bahamas Games are on the way. July 7th through the 15th. Get ready for inter-island sporting competition in the spirit of unity and camaraderie. Which island is gonna win? It's the Bahamas Games. Our nation, our talent, our games. And look out for the B Games crew coming to your island soon. For more information, call 809-1242. Or visit thebahamasgames.org.
My business couldn't survive without my credit card machine from Fidelity.
It's fast, convenient, and my clients love it.
My sales increase, and I can track my earnings.
Get your credit card machine from Fidelity today.
Call 356-7764. Fidelity.
We're good for you.
At Wendy's, we are different.
We don't just use beef. It's fresh, never frozen.
Our burgers are square because we never cut corners.
Served hot off the grill with fresh lettuce, tomatoes, onions, and American cheese.
We believe in fast food done right.
Always serving fresh, never frozen beef.
Order a hot, juicy Dave single, double, or triple.
Made with fresh, never frozen beef.
Now only at Wendy's. Different inside and out.
Guardian Radio and the Foundation are on the move.
Bahamas, this one's for you.
SBT. Small Business Thursdays. Every Thursday, the Foundation with Howard Grant will highlight small businesses throughout the country, far and wide. Your products, services, prices, and personality. We want to hear it all. Get your 30 or 60 second advertisement heard on air at a fraction of the cost. We here at the Foundation understand the times and don't want you to be left behind. With Guardian Radio, you reach your specific demographic and it is unmatched.
We reach thousands daily.
Get your products off the shelf and your services in their hearts. Small Business Thursdays with the Foundation, only on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. For more information, call 302-2300 or the Help Me Howard line at 827-0111. SBT. Small Business Thursdays. Get your business moving today.
Foundation. The Foundation.
And we are back, ladies and gentlemen, 96.9 FM Radio. Howard Grant in your company, The Foundation. Beautiful day, Monday, May 1st. Chopping it down with none other than Maurice Tynes in the house. I was just about to hit you with the former chief, but he told me he's his former clerk. In the House of Assembly, right? Amongst all, he's been able to really be able to serve stellar in his 24 years of service. He's been retired for a few years now, but still remains committed to service in the country, and I'm grateful for that. Right up, you asked me if I'd taken texts. I got few texts, but the lines have been lit up straight through. So let me see if I can take a next telephone call. Caller, you on the line with us live. Go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon to you, Mr. Maurice Tynes. How are you all?
Fantastic. How you doing?
I'm fine, thank you.
I'm blessed. Mr. Tynes,
yes,
this
ma'am.
Is crime. You gave
yes,
me that
yes.
nickname.
Yes, Ms. Johnson.
Because I was there posted in the House of Assembly reference to select committee. And everything that I share on this radio has now come to fruition for my mortal boss, mm-hmm. former Prime Minister Hubert Alexander Ingram, and the two prime ministers I still defend because their hands are clean. And now you see everything is coming out, right? This is Maurice Tynes. This is Berenice Johnson, the original.
Yeah, I know this young man, Ms. Johnson.
Very well, Miss Verne Grant.
Yeah, that's my mother.
Yes, she's okay, a wonderful it's, lady.
Please,
I tell her, I respect her and love her, but
she
I told you
right now.
All the time.
She can
I
hear
told you, because you just run right out, Mr. Howard Grant, sometimes.
Okay.
Now, God bless you, Mr. Tynes. I only want to put this on the record while I was there. The Select Committee on Crime that Mr. Ingram tried to put it through, and nobody voted for it. And I was there. That is why I was posted there from 2008 and with Mr. Christie. And they were trying to overthrow Mr. Brave Davis now, and it shall not happen in Jesus' mighty name, because I'm still standing and defending them wholeheartedly. Thank you. God bless you all.
Thank you so much for your telephone call. That was quick and to the point. Let's see if we can get the next telephone call in. Caller, you're on the line with us live. Go ahead.
Afternoon, Howard.
Good afternoon.
And a good afternoon, Brother Dines. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you.
How's retirement?
Oh, I'm enjoying it.
Okay, that's good. That's good. Now, Howard, now let's get real, man. You leave out some stuff, Howard.
Okay, what I leave out?
Why MPs and is leave their $150,000 job to come be an MP or member of parliament, and the richest man in the Bahamas became a member of parliament. Man, come on now, the perks too. The traveling around the world off the government expenses, chauffeur, kickbacks, you know, the contract only weighed $80,000, but you put in for $1.5 million, and when they get paid, they got to give you that.
But
all
this,
go, man.
All this,
go, man.
Yeah,
come
see,
on, come on, come on. Oh, I'm in the barbers now. I'm 53. I've been around here a little while.
All this come is speculation.
On.
We can't.
Yeah, there's speculation.
It's
but we on the ground, we know what's going on, man. Bremen, right. You as a lawyer, you're making $350,000 a year. You believe that to go for the $28,000 and the $68,000, $66,000? Bobby Idol, man, to get friends, family, and lovers straight. But I really call for that. That's
okay,
what I really call for.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree to Brother Dines, what he say earlier. But how the police is just come pick you up off your job and everything and all that. Because we had a defense force officer who had someone claim incest, his daughter claim incest on him.
Don't call no names.
No,
no,
no, no, no name.
Okay,
I don't know the name.
Go ahead.
But I guess saying, they pick him up right away. And they had the police with incest. They pick him up. They say if the girl lying or the little girl or daddy might have beat her and she gets lying, let's wait till he come in. Just explain how it go. No, they go and pick them up right
wow.
away and bring them in. So, and then they tell him on his own, really, he could come in when he ready. You know, me or you, dying happened to us. Now, this is the last one here, too. Mr. Tynes, elections have to be less than 4 or 5 years, but it can't be more than 5 years.
Yes, unless there's a provision in the Constitution that permit the prime minister to go over a couple months. But
okay, why are you saying that, right? Because you know the history of the Bahamas, our elections used to be in 2007. You know, that's 62, 67, 72, 77, 82, 87, 92, 80, you know, 2002, 2007, straight on like that. But
yes.
You see, I mean, let's come and switch that right up, changing up now. Mm-hmm. Elections could be on 1 and 6.
No, that wasn't the first time it happened in our generation.
No.
Yeah, but see, I asked Mr. Jones when I was on the show one time about that, and you know, I really could explain it to me.
Okay, let me see
if I can let him answer.
Let me see if I can help you out. Up until 1962, the parliamentary term used to be 7 years. You used to have elections every 7 years unless they do it quicker. In 62, it was shortened to 5 years,
mm-hmm.
okay? The Constitution provides the Prime Minister with the discretion of proroguing or dissolving Parliament at any time.
Mm-hmm.
That's a wide discretion the Prime Minister has.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been done a few times that I can remember. In 60, right, actually... The famous election of 1967, that term only lasted 1 year. They got elected in January 10th.
66, right?
And then the parliament was dissolved in January of the next year or February of the next year.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a general election in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's nothing unusual. But that was done because a member, the don't forget now, the parliament was tied up 1818, and when a member of the PLP died, Uriah McPhee, and so rather than go to a by-election, the prime minister at that time, Sir Lyndon, thought that it was better, well, he wasn't prime minister then, was he? Yeah, 67, yeah.
He was in prime minister until 73? After the
okay.
So he
but
was.
Anyhow, he was the premier or the prime minister, one of the two, and he thought it was better to have a general election rather than have a by election,
because that general census, the consensus is the same consensus that exists for referendums. If whatever you have, this vote is a depiction of the people's position for this political organization. That hasn't changed in this country. And that is why I believe that political organizations are afraid to disrupt anything as it relates to a by-election or anything, because this is a depiction of how the people feel about your governance. This is how it's happened from time immemorial, from I remember it.
Yep.
So they've been kind of reluctant to kind of do that. Let me see if I can take a next telephone call. Let's see if we can get these out quick, ladies and gentlemen. We give you one question. I see you got six pile up. Go ahead, caller. Call Young with this live. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hey, go ahead, sir.
Yeah. Good afternoon. How you doing, Alan?
All is well.
Okay. I just wanted to comment on what Mr. Tyne said a little earlier in the show,
mm-hmm.
where he actually acknowledged that there are two different conversations taking place regarding a member of parliament and the allegation. There's one conversation regarding the procedures, regulations, and behavior regarding the member of parliament being picked up, right? And versus, I guess, everyday citizens. And there's another conversation regarding his assumption of innocence until proven guilty And the fact that he hasn't even been charged, much less presented before the courts to defend his innocence or his presumption of innocence. And I think people are conflating the two issues, and I just wanted to highlight Mr. Tyne's response regarding that matter, and including where he went a bit further, and he acknowledged that there is a standing situation with the former executive chairman of Water and Sewage and current member of parliament for Long Island. I know that you didn't take him up on that, Howard, but I'm expressing the exact same point that Mr. Tyne's expressed when you had the reverend on your show last week, Friday. Thank you for the opportunity. Good day to you, Mr. Tynes, and continued blessings in your retirement.
Thank you, sir.
You see, when you called the other day, it was an avenue to be able to deflect from the position. There was allegations, and this goes to all members, in my view, right? We hear, I hear, in this particular capacity, talk about integrity and conviction. That is across the board. It's not isolated to PLP or FNM. It's integrity and conviction. Every member of parliament in the House of Assembly has prefixed, attached to their name, honorable. The honorable, honorable men, honorable women in this particular capacity. My only question has been, based upon the honorability, what is the expectation for the next step? After these social allegations come to the forefront, and I gave a clear example, if it was Howard Grant, this is what Howard Grant would do. Bam. I would have to take on that kind of position. So, you know, that's sort of the position. I see your telephone calls on the line. I don't know if I can get to another one. I give you 30 seconds, caller. Caller, you on the line with us live. Go ahead. Go ahead, caller. Okay, no. Mr. Tynes, I want to thank you so much, man. I really do. I think you give significant clarity to these particular matters and very steady and sober-minded to be able to talk about these things. A lot of times we find persons impassioned to talk about these things that we can't really ingest the information. You have been steadfast in being able to talk about that and committed. Years after your retirement, you're still talking about governance in the Bahamas. What is our expectation in times to come? You can tell us when we can see your book or what's going to happen. Talk to me about it.
No, I can't tell you when you can see my book.
Okay.
Because I am back and forth on it with it, you know. I have some other projects I'm working on. I have to get them out of the way. And so as soon as I finish them, probably by next month, I'll go back to my book.
So is there anything that you do? So we just have to kind of wait out for you to be able to give your pronouncements in the letters to the editor. So
yes. And in reading my letters, you'll be partly reading my book.
Yes. Okay. Well, that's excellent. Ladies and gentlemen, that is none other than Maurice Tyne really being able to chop it down with us today. I had a great conversation. There's a couple of texts that came through to talk about these things. I see some texts here talking about Anton. I really don't want to talk about it. I just want to talk about the necessity to identify a particular standard being held in this country. That's it. That's it. Do we hold up the standard? Just like Mr. Tynes talked about the supremacy that exists within the Constitution, are we going to hold up this particular standard to ensure that there is progression and growth in these areas? That's it. That's all I want to do. I want to be able to commit myself to an idea and align myself with those things. I want to dive deeper into a conversation about reform as it relates to parliamentary amalgamations or being paid in those particular areas. So we're going to do that one of these days and talk about it. Tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen, can I do this? I'm going to do this. Tomorrow, we have Ellsworth Johnson, former cabinet minister under the Minnis administration, going to be able to sit with us. I know you say, oh my God, Howard. All week this week, we got Paul. Wednesday, I tried to do something decent, but the gentleman says to me that he was unable to kind of sit with me. So we're going to hold back on that. We're going to go parliamentarians all week, former parliamentarians and persons who could be able to speak to this. We're getting into the politics this week, so we can do that. Tomorrow, like I said, is going to be Ellsworth Johnson sitting in the studio with us, chopping it down. He's confirmed. We're going to make that thing happen. Ladies and gentlemen, I thank you so very kindly for kind of tuning in with us today. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. Mr. Tynes, I want to thank you again for being able to participate in that. And And we wish you all the absolute best as you continue to do great things and lift up a standard here in the country, my brother. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for those kind words.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, 96.9 FM Radio, Howard Grant and your company, please stick and stay for Shivago Lang with Z Live right after this. Have a great day, guys. We're going to see you next time.
Foundation. The foundation. The foundation.